Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a Fresh Science Studio program. This is Keith's panel, and today I'm going to be having a long, interesting conversation with Professor Deepinwita Dasgupta. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Texas at El Paso, and for some reason, many, many years ago, decided that she'd like to specialize in the philosophy of science. Not being a scientist, it's like me deciding I want to suddenly become a philosopher. How does this happen? So, Deepinwita, we're going to have a long conversation with you. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith.
Now, before we get into what you are and what your interests are, let's tell us a little bit about how on earth did you get to where you started in India to where you are now? What were your ideas of anything when you were a young child or a young lady?
Okay. I was born and raised in India, in very northeast India, in fact, where all the tea comes from. I was born and raised in the state of Assam. And a little bit about my family background, my father was a mechanical engineer. He was one of the first generation of engineers right after the independence. So I grew up there, and I learned to read, this might be interesting, when I was three, by sitting on the huge Indian epic book called Ramayana. So I think that argues that I had some interest in books.
Yes.
It is, and I think one should remember that we are the first generation in India of planned children. So we are literally planned, like you plan a five-year national something. So there was an atmosphere at home to systematically teach the children everything under the sun. So whether this is from English language to Mahabharata, to the international literature, everything. So I grew up in that atmosphere. I was born in a Brahmin family, so you know the scholarship somewhat comes naturally to them.
Right. Tell me, when you were reading, were you also, like I am right now doing this radio show with you, drinking tea?
Yes, actually coffee, not tea.
Oh, interesting. But Assam is so well known for tea. Wasn't it a bit of a renegade action to be drinking coffee?
Well, you know, when I do formal things, I do like as people do in Rome, so I drink coffee. But when I come back to my domestic side, I drink tea. So I've divided the world nicely between the internal and the external.
Okay, carry on. So you grew up in this family where learning and scholarship was sort of just taken for granted.
Yes, it is taken for granted. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a kind of amateur scholar, and he used to give us books to read. And these are serious books. These are Nietzsche. These are Somerset Maugham. These are American writers like Grapes of Wrath. Bible, of course. I started with King James. And then both myself and my brother, we read Plato's Republic when I was 13. So I think before that, I had some idea that I might become a classical historian, maybe ancient Greece or Rome or ancient Mesopotamia. But reading Plato made me shift my interest towards philosophy. I wanted to know in which major you get to read such texts more. And it turned out that was philosophy.
And how old
were you? As an undergraduate, enrolled in college as a philosophy major. And that was my start in philosophy. I did two master's degrees and two PhDs, one from India and the other now from the United States. And even though I started in philosophy as a philosopher of language, eventually, when I came over to the United States, I shifted to philosophy of science.
Okay. Well, I got several questions here, but... Well, first of all, how old were you when you actually decided on philosophy? It was not clear whether you were 10 or 20 or 15 or
I think it was about 16 or 17. Before that, I was somewhat omnivorous. I would read whatever I could. I mean, I did not have much English at that stage, so I could not read a lot of English book.
But you did read the Bible.
English later.
Let's just cut that piece out. Sam, you're listening, I hope, and I'm going to be interacting with Deepinwita to ask questions, but she sometimes doesn't hear. So the other question that I'd like to know, you say you read the King James Version of the Bible.
Yes.
This is somewhat unusual, or would your family steeped in Christianity, or what?
No, no. We are definitely Hindu Brahmins, but
yes,
I think plenty of Hindus read Bible, not because of religious lineage, but because everything that is universal under the sun should be learned.
Okay.
I did read Quran as well. And in fact, I think I know my Islam much better than Christianity. I did read more ancient texts like Jandavesta. So that is the Persian, probably the first example of monotheism. So my grandfather thought that there should not be any distinction, and the children should be taught all forms, all systems, so that they can make an enlightened choice.
Okay. So what about other activities when you were 50? Did you do any sport? I mean, was there any physical release from all this intellectual reading?
Well, we lived in the middle of the jungle, so there was plenty of walking in the actual forest. And, you know, all Indian children play cricket. So I certainly played cricket with my brother and all the kids in the neighborhood, and
okay,
broke various windows of our neighbor's house. But that is probably the only thing I can remember.
Were you a good batsman? You have a good hand-eye coordination?
No, I think I was mostly a bowler. Even though my brother actually really minded getting out. So whenever, yeah.
Very nice. Okay, so two master's degrees, two PhDs. Let's start with the first PhD. Where did you study for your PhD in India?
In Jadavpur University in Calcutta. And this is the college from which my father also graduated as an engineer many years back. So when I did, in the Indian system, you actually specialize, you have both the Western philosophy and Indian philosophy. And eventually, when you do your master's degree, you have to specialize in one. Now, like many modern Indian families, I can read some Sanskrit, but I cannot read it fluently. And you cannot do philosophy unless you read the original texts. But
okay,
I could read English, so eventually I went to Western philosophy. So when I was starting on my PhD, I was obviously doing it in the Western tradition. And in the Western tradition, I chose Quine's Indeterminacy of Translation. So it is a metaphysical problem, but then I was in philosophy of language. But at some point, I gave up that. I thought that more important problem of the day is really philosophy of science, to understand what science is, where it is going, in what kind of different relationships it can have with other disciplines of knowledge.
So when you make this decision, and now you're in the 20s, did it become part of your expectation or your desire to actually learn some science? Did you take science courses? Did you delve into the mysteries of chemistry and physics and mathematics? I know philosophers are great at mathematics, but did you actually look at any of the more physical sciences?
Not while I was in India, and partly the Indian university system is responsible for that. You know that there is the cut between the arts and science, and you cannot enroll in the class on either side. That's different in the American systems. But when I came to the U.S., then I did. Yeah, I audited lots of physics classes, and it is quite expected for philosophers of science to know at least some of the language of physics, because, you know, physics used to be called natural philosophy, and some mathematics. So I can basically read a reasonably complex scientific paper. I might miss some technical details here and there, but I would understand what the researcher is trying to do.
So if I was to ask you,
the classics of science, from Galileo to Newton.
If I was to ask you to come and talk to my classes, the freshmen or something, and I say, just out of the blue, Steve, what is string theory all about? What would you say? Would you, like I would, throw my hands up in the air and say, it's beyond me? Or would you have something to say about string theory?
String theory, you might remember, actually has often been blamed as a philosophical theory and not a physics theory at all. Because it thinks about the fundamental structure of the world and the fundamental units, what do they look like? And the idea was they are point particles. And point particles don't always give us the properties we are looking for. So the alternative idea is this could be highly complex compressed strings of 10 or 11 dimensions. But in that area, physics comes very, very, very close to philosophy. Because now we are talking about things which we cannot even, we cannot see at all without any instruments.
Right.
The only thing we can see is with our mathematics.
So you see that physics is coming back to its natural philosophy roots, and there's going to be more need for people like yourself who can bridge this and then at some stage come and talk to scientists like me and say, Keith, you've really got to realize and then explain things to me. But we'll come back to that later. Now, you've been at the University of Texas at El Paso for coming up for 5 years.
Yes.
And you have made quite an impact, I will tell you, on me. All right.
I hope so. Thank you.
Well, no. I enjoy listening to you. I enjoy talking to you. And I really enjoy that you have made it your business to come every week, if you can, and usually you can, to the Department of Chemistry regular seminar program. And that's where we bring in guests from around the country, sometimes from outside of the country, to talk about their particular interesting research in science. And you always come up with a question at the end, which quite often puts a very perplexed look on the face of the person, because they're not used to getting these philosophical sort of tinged questions. So tell me very briefly what it is. Why are you doing that? What is it that you see your career developing that needed this sort of pretty much regular contact with practicing scientists that don't really think about the philosophy of the science that they're doing?
Okay. It really comes from my own research project. When I did my PhD in philosophy of science all over again at the University of Minnesota, I really wanted to put together a framework that would explain how the sciences were transmitted to the non-Western context. So I came up with a framework, and that will be soon published in a book. But then I realized that what we called the sciences really are not a bunch of technical disciplines only to be limited to some professional people. And I'm going back to the history of science. When 17th century science started, it started as an enlightenment, movement of enlightenment, and what we call scientific revolution. That was really an attempt to discover the structure of the world. So science in its essence is absolutely the same thing as philosophy. So I certainly want to know what today's professional scientists feel like about their projects, not just their project that is on the bench today, but where they're going with it, what problems they want to solve with it, and what do they think they're going to leave behind. So, and the best place you can discover for that is a research seminar. And research seminars are free. They're public. Anybody can come in. And I should point out is my specialty is scientific thinking. That means the way I have seen many chemists, they put together molecule. If I talk to a scientist for some time, I can figure out how this person puts together different strategies and different lines of thought in order to create a certain outcome. So that's what I look for. I look for the thinking behind the presentation.
Okay.
And whenever I see something I don't understand in how they think about their problem, I ask a question.
Yes, and sometimes they're very perceptive questions. And in fact, I remember many of your questions tend to go back to the idea, look, young man or young lady, old lady, who's ever giving the talk, here you are talking about, you know, big new ideas and big new approaches. And yet you seem to have missed out the fact that around the world, other people have come up with less technical solutions. And so how do you put in perspective your research and your projections of utility, if you can put it that way, into other societies that think differently but are working towards the same thing in some sense.
Yeah, that is, I think, let me put it that way. I think that really comes from how we designed our science education today. I think scientists today, the trainee scientists, no longer read the history of science. So because they no longer read the history of science, in a sense, they're trapped within the memory of two generations, their own generations and their mentors' generations. So this being the case, very often you have a case of problem solving being offered as a case of science. The two are not necessarily the same. You can solve problems, but all problem solving has a framework. You are solving the problem for how many years? 30, 40, 50 years? And sometime, many of the presentations that I see, they solve the problem, maybe for 40 years. After 40 or 50 years, the problem will come back in a renewed form, in a more wicked form, let me put it that way. So as a philosopher, my interest is in the scientific thinking and how they're thinking about the problem. Most of the time, it seems that we are going towards very resource-heavy areas where you need expensive equipment, expensive labs, lots of grant money, lots of very specialized, trained people. This science is very different in the sense of science of Newton or science of Darwin. You know, their instruments are ridiculously simple. The science of Michael Faraday, if you go to the Royal Institution, you can see their so-called instruments. I think nobody would really quite call them instruments today, and yet they made grand discoveries on their very simple instrument.
His book, his series of lectures on the nature of a candle and the flame from a candle.
Right, the history of the candle.
Yeah, is wonderful reading, even today. I have a copy. I read it, well, I browse through it from year to year, but it's just really very special. So you're right. But on the other hand, that's where science has progressed, because using physicists, mathematicians with their software programs, chemistry, for example, has made leaps and bounds and does every now and again because of these new instruments. We gain new insights. So it's a perfectly normal evolution, if I can say that, of science. To get new instrumentation, we get new insights. We can now look at individual atoms moving around on surface, unheard of. But let me change topics a little bit, because there's one area that really endears me to you, and that is that for 40 years almost, I've been running a program called the Minority Access to Research Careers. More politically correct now, I suppose it's called Maximizing Access to Research Careers. But this was a federally funded by Congress line item budget to take about 600 students around the United States of what was called the sort of minority status, predominantly African-American, Asian, Pacific Asian Island, Asian Islanders, and after that, Hispanics, and encourage them into scientific careers to increase the diversity of the workforce. This was the sort of the push. And it's a very sensible push, because as the demographics of North America become less and less dominated by people like myself, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and now forget the Protestant, but just white Anglo-Saxon, and more and more Asians, more and more African-Americans, more and more Hispanics, are coming to be dominant in the population. They have not traditionally gone into science. And so this program, it was heavily funded, has been for 40-odd years, was an effort to sort of encourage this group of people to consider science as a career at the highest levels of PhD-level research. And you asked me a question about 3 years ago. You said, Keith, all this diversity in science, that is what you were alluding to, was more African-Americans, more Hispanics, etc. Does that do anything to increase the diversity of science itself? And that question has stuck with me for years. And so I'd like you to rephrase it or start again. What was the thought process behind that question?
Okay. So in most science department, it is not in science department, across all departments, in philosophy too, there are these diversity and inclusion. So the idea is simply that, yes, in every society you have minorities, and these minorities are underrepresented in the so-called academic and technological professional workforce. So let us bring them. And, of course, the more different when the different people come in, the expectation is your new kinds of thought would be added to the workforce, and therefore we'll have higher returns, we'll have new discoveries. I think it is a way of thinking that we'll have better discoveries and quicker discoveries if we bring in people from all kinds of communities. And there is really no problem with the idea as it stands. The problem is in the term diversity. And I'm a philosopher, so let me define a few terms first. What does diversity mean? Well, diversity might mean multiple things. One is you can make the human material diverse in the sense that you have a statistical representation of various population within the workforce. So you have made the human material more diverse. But there is the other question, the epistemic, the theory of knowledge, the conceptual diversity. And I think for the best and optimal kind of science, we actually need both. It is fine if many different kinds of people from multiple backgrounds, race and ethnicities, become part of the scientific workforce. People already have become so. But I think it is not quite so fine if all of us come together, create a bigger group, and then still do the same science. And let me put it, give you a kind of small example. So suppose you recruit every 20 students every cycle of the MARC program. So your scientific community becomes bigger in size. So it might have been 50 people, so now it will be 68 people every cycle. So you have a bigger scientific community, but is it at all the case that we are doing any different science? I don't think so. And that is the weakest link in the diversity efforts, because these newcomers will be trained in the same ways as their mentors. They will be trained in the same conceptual framework, same case studies, same diet of problems and problem solutions. So when they come out of it, they will become more or less copies of their mentors. So that's not actually diversity. That's homogenizing.
Well, hang on. Now let me ask you a question. You had mentors in philosophy.
Yes.
You had several of them. And, of course, you had your grandfather, who sounds just a very special gentleman. But
yeah.
do you not see that you are partly, at least, a representation of your mentors, too? You go in different directions, but, I mean, yes, indeed. That's my children. I mean, I think of mentoring at the fundamental level. I've got five children. And they all have characteristics that they have picked up from me, good ones and bad ones, I might add. That's natural. And what you're saying, in a sense, is science has got to be different. We must get away from that mentorship and then a little bit of imaging of the mentee by the mentor. I'm not quite. Science is doing fine, is my argument. And it will change by diverse ethnic and racial groups, as you put it, but it will evolve anyway by itself, and it's a healthy, inquiring activity. I still haven't quite got the idea of what's
okay.
wrong with being
so
somewhat like your mentor.
Nothing quite wrong with what is going on. The only problem is it is not going far enough, and not going far enough might actually have unusual consequences, unforeseen consequences. Let us go back to the word diversity. Diversity is a biological concept, and I think biologists use it all the time. And the classic image of diversity is the Darwin finches. So the mainland parent finch gave rise to all these island finch population. So certainly it is descended from the common ancestors, but they have now all become different. So that is diversity. And the problem in our current diversity efforts is not what is going in, but what is coming out. What is coming out is basically a copy of the mainstream scientists. And it is true of certainly most Indian universities. The two great colonial empires did this. The South Asian populations were created as a kind of Englishmen, and the French did the same as well. If you go to North Africa, in fact, if you just stand in Paris, you will see many North African people who are essentially really all Frenchmen. What is the problem in this? The problem is this, that you cannot call this diversity. You can call this the same software running in different kinds of hardware. And that we know. We know that we can run the same software in different kind of population, in different kind of human beings. But the problem is, you said that science is going to become diverse by this kind of training. Not so. Because the people who come out of such universities basically think like their mentors. And they try to follow rather than lead to new directions. And this is more or less the history of all colonial universities. They try to follow the Western scientific communities, pick up the problems that they have picked up, and very often they want to keep exactly very close to their mentors and their ancestors. So we are not going into new directions. We are creating a very homogeneous force.
Okay.
And other traditions are basically dying in want of membership and training. In fact, we are losing languages every day. We are probably losing different ways of doing things every day. Yeah.
Do you see anywhere, and let's go back to the Indian subcontinent, which has now been independent and with creative scientists, many of them I meet on a regular basis.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Do you see any hope where they are beginning to ease themselves away from in this case, the British model, or in other places, the French model or the Western model, let me put it that way. Do you see any silver linings where people in your background are beginning to say, hey, there's a better way, and we're doing it? And can you say there's one university system that I could go and study where this diversity of the sciences is particularly strong?
Well, there are plenty of silver linings, because I know several efforts where people are doing interesting things. In a way, they are going back to the days of the Enlightenment and scientific revolution and looking at things in a new kind of way. So these are the different attempts that might be called philosophically little science. That means not putting 100% of your eggs in the basket of resource-rich, very expensive instrument-based science. There are many other ways science can be done. There are different kinds of people which might become involved in doing science. I'll give you a quick example of a young professor who is, I think, in Stanford. He's a bioengineer, but his specialty is designing, you know, very cheap instruments that can replace expensive things like a microscope or a centrifuge and take it to absolutely to the line of care.
I know about this. Yeah, okay. Look, Deep, we've run out of our allotted 28 minutes. But we will come into another program on this, and we'll carry on another program from the end point where we are now. So you begin to talk about these silver linings. But thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation. You're at your house. I'm in my house. Sam Cassiano's in the studio. This hermitry, as I call it in my case, it's interesting because I'm beginning to think more than do more. I cannot do much here. I can read, I can walk, and I have to think a lot because I've got no instruments to play with. So this could be a good beginning.
Yeah, well, you can always go back to the Faraday bottle.
Yes, indeed. Deepan Weetadas Gupta, Professor of Philosophy, specializing in philosophy of science. Thank you very much for being here, and I hope to see you soon,
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Adios.
For
all right, bye-bye. And I'd like to thank Sam Cassiano for putting the program together. Three different people in three different locations. And I'd like to thank you for listening. We will be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Totally different topic, I'm sure. I don't know what yet, but stay tuned. Adios.